Welcome to Life's a Beach. I'm Bruce Hopkins, better known as Hoppo from Bondi Rescue. Each week I'll be sharing some stories, the good, the bad, and everything in between. I'll be chatting to guests about their life experiences and giving our listeners an insight to the challenges we have faced in our lives. We'll share a few jokes and some banter along the way, and hopefully our experiences will resonate with you. As the saying goes, while life's a beach, it can also be a bitch. Hey everyone, this week on Life's a Beach, I've got Will Bigelow in the beach shack, and he comes in to talk about his 48-hour run and how he was doing it for charity and the ups and downs he had throughout those 48 hours. Also, he's just had a newborn son called Lockie, and he went through some traumatic times with the baby and also his wife, who were both in critical condition, and he thought he may lose both of them. So sit back and have a listen to my chat with Will. This week in the beach shack, I've got Will Bigelow. He works with me down at Bondi Beach. He's got a great story where he did a 48-hour run. So we'll get in and have a chat. So welcome, Will, to the shack.
Thanks, Hop. Good to be here again. Looking forward to ripping into the chat, mate. It'll be good.
Yeah, mate. Well, I thought I'd get you on because you did an amazing thing a few months ago. So we'll go way back when you're preparing for it and, you know, where did the idea come to do a 48-hour run?
Yeah, look, mental instability is the first one. Yeah, look, the idea came from basically I've had this in the pipes for ages. I just didn't know how to attack it. I was originally just going to go out and do it just because I could, and then, you know, Bo, one of the boys from Bronny, who you know quite well as well, he was like, mate, I'd love to help. And he owns Bottle It, which is a mental health foundation. So it gave me more of an incentive to get started and, yeah, just get training for this 48-hour and do it for Bottle It. So, yeah, I just wanted to do something crazy just to prove to myself that, you know, after rugby I've still got that still got that fire, you know.
Well, mate, how that come about on, like, where you're going to do it? Obviously, you work at Bondi, so Bondi would have been a part of it, but how was the plan to the distance to keep going? Because you need to keep it entertaining to get going for 48 hours.
Yeah, look, the whole thing, just to try and keep it going, I originally, because I like to do things on my own, I really just wanted to just get it done, have no eyes on me, but that's not really conducive to raising money as well. So I think a few of the boys from work, you included, were sort of like, well, you've got to keep eyes on you. So start at Bondi, because I originally wanted to start at LARPA. And the reason I wanted to do this particular trail or this route is because it's hard for anyone who has done the coastal walk, even from Bondi to Bronte. There's stairs, hills, you know, it sucks. It's beautiful, but the terrain sucks. And you go further south or you go further north to LARPA or Watson's Bay, it just continues. It's relentless. And I really wanted to challenge myself. The whole thing was I just wanted to break myself physically and mentally, which sounds a bit sadistic, but, you know, after rugby, you're looking for that next edge. And this was the best route to do that, 48 hours of that, for anyone who kind of knows the place. It's hard. It's really bloody hard.
And it was, you know, it's probably better than sticking your head in a scrum, I suppose, you know, going out for a 48-hour walk.
Oh, don't get me wrong, mate. I do enjoy getting in there and, you know, roughing a few people up. But, yeah, this was a different kind of physicality. I enjoy both. But I think, you know, with the amount of head knocks that I've had, I think this is probably the safest bet for the body and the mind.
Now, obviously, when you mentioned it to the guys at the beach, and they would have been, you know, quite nice to you about it, you know, that when you told them you're going to do a 48-hour run, I think every single person said, you're one, a lunatic, two, you'll never make it. So what was that feeling like?
Yeah, that was it was actually pretty it was good, because I kind of feed off that banter, that, because there's a lot of people who will say, you know, we're all really close down there, and a lot of people will say things like a bit tongue-in-cheek, like, you know, you won't you're not going to make it, or you're not going to do it, or you're full of it, whatever. But to me, that kind of fuels my fire, and I just go, stuff you, I'm ready. I'm like, I'll do this. I'll prove you wrong. And, you know, some of the boys who I am closest with down there were the ones to give me the biggest amount of hell. Blokes like Boo, Reedy, Harrison, Whippet, like they hammered me. And I was like, I've got you, just don't worry. So it was all like, at the end of the day, it was all love, and the boys were just, you know, doing what they do and just being smart asses. But they didn't realize that it was actually fueling the fire to do something pretty cool. So I've got to thank them as well. But, you know, at the same time, they really were backing me too at the end of the day. And I think they also knew that what they were doing was fueling the fire a little bit, because they wanted to see me probably, one, hurting in the Hurt Locker for a long time, but they also probably wanted to see me accomplish something, because, like I said, we're all super close down there. So it was pretty cool.
And you came up with a time to do it around Christmas, but you did have another date earlier, didn't you? You were going to do it.
Yeah. So earlier that year, I got married, and I thought, you know, all right, I'm going to finish, you know, my stint of having, you know, not a wife, just, you know, have a fiance, and I'll finish that stint, and I'll finish it on a high, and then I'll get married. And so for ages, I was like, yeah, all right, this is what I'm going to do. This is what I'm going to do. And as the stress of the wedding kept, you know, building and building, as you know, you go, okay, maybe, yeah, this is going to be cool. And, you know, Ella put a foot down. She goes, look, I love you, but you're not really here for the wedding. I think you're thinking about this 48-hour run more than you are our wedding. And I was like, yeah. She goes, can we compromise and maybe you just do it after the wedding? Because I also want to be able to dance with you, and I feel like you're not going to be able to walk. And I was like, oh, yeah, fair call. We'll postpone it. So, yeah, it was probably a blessing for it to happen the way it did, because I wouldn't have been able to dance or have a good time at my wedding. I would, you know, not that I was really wearing shoes at my wedding, but I definitely wouldn't be able to put any form of shoes on. Yeah, so I was glad that Ella kind of sat me down and gave me a stern talking to about it, which was good. I needed it, because I can run away with ideas sometimes.
Yeah, so then after the wedding, which was a great wedding, so then you decided that you picked a date, and you probably picked it around the hottest part of the year. It's between Christmas and New Year's, probably the busiest and hottest week get down there at Bondi.
Yeah. I don't know. Look, like I said, if I wanted it, this was my train of thought for this whole 48 hours, was no matter what time of the year I picked it, it was either going to be winter, and if it was going to be cold and wet, I wanted it to be really bloody cold and really bloody wet, or if it was going to be summer, which it was, I wanted it to be really bloody hot. I don't want that comfortable, happy medium, you know, where you just, because that wasn't the idea of it. I wanted to break myself. I really wanted to, see what I had left in me. And so, yeah, I chose that time of the year because when I wanted to do it, Ella and I, we went on a honeymoon, had a great time in Thailand. And then, you know, probably about 3 or 4 weeks after the honeymoon, Ella goes, I'm pregnant. And I was like, oh, that's great, but I'm going to have to push back to 48 hours now. I was like, okay, cool. Well, let's just focus on this. And then come the end of the year, and I was starting to talk to Bo a lot more about it. And he was like, let's just do it in summer. You know, it'll link up well. There'll be a lot of eyes, you know, come that Christmas, New Year's period. There are people away, but there's no sport on. There's nothing to distract people. It's hot. People are going to be down at the beach. It's a great way to raise money and get eyes on what you're doing. So let's do it in between that Christmas, New Year period. And I was like, yeah, all right, cool. Pull the trigger. Let's get it started.
And do you remember what the toughest thing was that you've ever done prior to doing this 48 hours?
Mate, the hardest thing that I ever did was probably the Bondi to Manly, which is my first ultra marathon. And I did that, I think. So the lead up to this was because people were really skeptical. Like, as you know, I'm a big bloke. I'm not built like blokes like Reedy, Mitch Scott, all those runners. I'm a rugby player. You know, I'm a rugby player that's a lifeguard, square pegging around hole. And so the boys wanted to test me to make sure that I was ready for this, and I wasn't going to buckle under the pressure. So Reedy actually, a week he gave me a week's notice and he called me out publicly and said, all right, Will, you're doing the Sydney Marathon. So he got me a ticket for that. I did the Sydney Marathon. And then Bo was like, okay, well, I'm a bit dubious about this whole 48 hours leading up to it, because there's a lot of pressure from his side to being a new foundation. And he was, and also a very close friend of mine, he was worried about my safety, which is a massive thing, because the whole time I'm saying, I'm doing it on my own, I'm doing it on my own, I don't want help, I'm doing it on my own. So he's like, righto, mate, we'll put you in the Bondi to Manly and see how that breaks you. And that was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. That Bondi to Manly put me to the sword. I was in the world's worst pain. I never thought it was possible. Yeah, that was the hardest thing that I've ever done, the most challenging thing. But as soon as I crossed that finish line, I was like, yeah, I can do this 48 hours. If I can get through that, I can do the 48 hours.
So that was the first thing you thought when you crossed the line, you're in absolute agony and you're thinking, and how long did that take you, the 80K?
So the 80K, it was hard, because the 80K, you have to make checkpoints. If you don't make those checkpoints, you get a DNF. So there's about four or five checkpoints. Each are about, four checkpoints, each are about 20 Ks between each other. And so you've got to push yourself, and you really have to push it, because you don't want to fail. You don't want to be the person to be kicked out of the race. Mm-hmm. That terrain, that course is relentless, like ridiculously hard. North Sydney, the hills, I have never seen. It was like being on Cronulla sand dunes, but for miles and miles and miles. It was just, it was every hill I saw, I had a tear coming down my face, just going, I don't want to do this. So, as soon as I crossed that finish line, Reedy was actually on the mic with another bloke. And Reedy, get big embrace. Bo was there too, because Bo was supporting me through Bottle It. And, I crossed the line, the bloke goes, what's next? And I just went, mate, I'm running for 48 hours at the end of the year. And he was like, oh, what? And the first question was, mate, how big are you? In my head, I was like, it doesn't matter how big I am. I just said I'm going to do it, so I'm going to get it bloody done. So, yeah, there was no – my kind of state of mind is, once I say I'm going to do something, I do it. I don't care how it is going to look leading up, but I'm going to get it done. If there's no preparation, I'm still going to show up and I'm still going to get it done. It can take the 48 hours. I could have gone, half the distance that I actually did, but I would have kept going for 48 hours. So that was kind of the lead up. And the hardest challenge I'd done before the 48 hours was that Bondi to Manly. It was, we had all conditions. It was pissing down in the morning to scorching hot in the middle of the day, and then freezing, the last quarter of the run. And it was, the terrain was just, it killed me, absolutely killed me. I remember calling Ella up, and I had just gone, I was just over the halfway point, and I was like, I don't think I can do this. I do not think I can do this. And she was just like, okay, well, you do realize you can stop. And I was like, nah, can't stop. As soon as someone tells me, you do realize you don't have to do this, I was like, well, what's the point of me being here if that was my attitude going in? So I kept doing it. And then Whippet called me probably about 40 minutes later. And he was like, mate, don't kill yourself over this. Like, no one's going to be upset that you didn't finish it. And I was like, stuff you, Whippet, you know what I'm like. And I think he knew what he was doing to me. So he was firing me up. And so, I pushed through thanks to those phone calls. And but it was, mate, it was painful. It was really, really painful.
And then, you, as you said, you had a lot of help for the 48 hours. I think you got someone to come and help you that was an ultramarathon runner. Because obviously the issue you would have, not only physically, it's, blisters, things to go wrong outside of, your own control. So how did you prepare for that?
Yeah, look, I was super, super lucky to be put into contact with a bloke named Jamie Hilditch. And for anyone who doesn't know who Jamie Hilditch is, look him up. He's, when it comes to ultra running, especially in Australia, he is a bloody guru. He's done so many races. He was telling me a story. I can't remember exactly what race it was, but there's a race, I think it's the Simpson Desert race or something. And he was the first year he's done it. He's the only bloke to do it 2 years consecutively. He fractured something in his leg and he still came second. He did it on the first quarter of the race. And this is an ultra race in the middle of the desert. And he came second. And then the next year he showed up the next year and he won. He's a freak. And his knowledge about nutrition, training, rest, like all of that is second to none. There were two blokes between Jamie Hilditch and John from the MAP movement, who was like a physio and just making sure my body stayed together. He's an exercise physiologist too. Between those two blokes, I wouldn't have been able to get it done. Jamie's also a mindset coach. So because as you know, when I'm training or running, I'm quite negative towards myself. Like, you know, you're too big, you're too heavy, come on, you fat idiot, whatever. Mm-hmm. Like I speak really negatively to myself, and that works for a short period of time. And I was talking to him about it. He's like, you know, what's your motivation? And I was like, oh, I'm a bit of a bastard to myself, you know, like I'm quite hard on myself. And he's like, that's great. He goes, but that's not going to work for 48 hours when you haven't slept. He goes, you need to be kind to yourself, and you need to be. And that was the biggest shift in my mental, was just to be kind to myself, which doesn't, I've turned that off now. That doesn't work anymore that I'm not doing a 48 hour, but it did help. Cause if I was saying all that stuff to myself, like you're weak, you can't do this or whatever, I wouldn't have been able to finish it. I would have finished it, but I would have been in a way worse position finishing than what I actually was when I was positive to myself. So he just changed the game for me in terms of how to treat myself leading up to it. But yeah, those two blokes, John and Jamie, were so crucial for me to start and to finish. And they also put everyone else's mind at ease. Bo, Ella, my family, Ella's family. They put those two blokes put everyone's mind at ease because they were there. Jamie did not leave my side the whole time. He was in a van tracking me, doing my waters, doing my feeds, making sure that everyone who was around me was giving me my nutrition. And Jamie could not be more on point about my nutrition. There was 48 feed bags that Ella had prepared 2 days before, snakes, lollies, bars, like you name it, just full of crap, but all calories that I needed. And he just made sure that everything was on point. Every time I had a stop, he was filling up my water bottles. John would then come in and massage my legs at the pit stops and make sure, because he's an exercise physiologist, he was, you know, one of my hips, one side of my hip hikes up higher than the other. And he was like, mate, you're hiking now. Let's remember those things that we practiced. Try and stride it out and see how you go. And it just had my mind at ease that if, you know, shit was to hit the fan, those two guys were there to sort of pick up the pieces and keep me going. So it was just those two guys, Jamie and John, they were just so, so good. I scream their names from the bloody rooftops. They were unbelievable.
And, mate, when the time came where the day was there and you had to go down, you know, was there nerves? The people came down to see you start. What was the feeling like when you're about to start?
Yeah. So when we pulled up at the back of the pavilion, and Ella and I were in the car, and then it started, like the heavens just opened up and it started pissing down, and I just felt sick, instantly felt sick. I was like, the last thing that I wanted was to have wet shoes to start for 48 hours, wet shoes, wet socks. Like it was Bondi to Manly all over again. And I was like, oh, this is what I wanted. And then it stopped. Like when I say it pissed down, there were puddles everywhere. Like it wasn't a light sprinkle. It came down and let us know about it. Jamie then showed up and kind of like all my nerves just kind of went away a bit because I was just so focused on what I had to do in that time. And then, yeah, that all happened really quick. And then we got down to the start line in front of the promenade and that behind the tower there. And I looked around and then there's just people everywhere. The boys from who weren't working showed up. And they were cheering me on. And then there were the people I haven't seen in ages, boys from rugby showed up, and families that I train outside of work they were there to support me. My family were there. And it was just this weird moment because I didn't expect anyone to be there. Like, I was just going to, the gun was going to go and I was going to go for 48 hours, but there were people there supporting, and then Bondi Rescue were filming, and I couldn't really think about how I was feeling because there was so much going on. People were, you know, tapping me on the ass, tapping me on the back, you know, you got this. And it was awesome. It was so cool. It actually took my mind off the nerves, but at the same time, it took my mind off thinking about what I had to do, because next minute Bo was making a speech and I looked at my watch and I went, oh crap, it's 4 o'clock. I've got to go. And I just started running. So it was, the lead up didn't have as much pressure on it as I thought, because it all happened so quick, you know. And then next minute I'm running down the promenade on my own and I'm like, this is it. This is the start. We're off to the races here. So it was pretty cool.
And then, you know, obviously the first few hours would have been okay. And was there a point where it started kicking in? What point was that? You know, you thought, I'm at the 5 hour, 6 hour mark. Or was there a certain point where you thought, okay, now this is the real thing?
Yeah. I think it was probably about 4 hours in, and we had looped around South Head. Because, you know, it was like the hype was there. People were running behind me. Harry's jumped out of a car with, you know, Emily and the kids. He jumped out and joined us to South Head. And then, it was just like South Head and then running back. And it was starting to get dark. And I was like, all right, this is where you got to switch on. This is where, you know, you can't let off here, because you're only, you know, 4 or 5 hours in, whatever it is. You still got to make it to Lapa. You haven't even done your first proper lap. And so we got back to Bondi and everyone's like, you know, how are you feeling? Jamie was there and, I was like, yep, feeling good. Everything's all right. So then we went from Bondi, obviously made our way to Maroubra, and that's where Reedy came in. And then head torches were on, and Reedy's kind of set the pace, and we're running through the golf courses around Malabar and everything. And, yeah, it was pretty cool. But once we got to Lapa, it's really hard to describe, because you know you have to concentrate, but at the same time you have to relax, because it's such a long way. 48 hours on your feet is a long bloody time. And yeah, I just kind of had to take it each hour by hour. So 1 hour goes down, I'm like, okay, cool, tick. Another hour goes down, tick. And you kind of, every hour you kind of reset. So yeah, it wasn't easy, but I don't know. It's a really hard thing to sort of look back on and describe and say, you know, when did you have to start switching on? You had to stay on the whole time. The thing that helped the most was the fact that people were coming in and out. So you had fresh energy, you know, new voices, new chat. Jethro was really good. Like, I went, and Bo was with me for this time. Jethro was, because he brought the humor. And Jeff's a runner. Like, Jeff can run, but I think it was about 2 a.m. We were running from Maroubra to Malabar. No one is around. It is pitch black, and Bo was telling me this. He goes, oh, I just got to take a phone call. And I was like, okay, it's 2 a.m. Like, who's calling? Like, what's going on? And then next minute, Jeff starts talking. Yeah, I'm just on this walk with Will, blah, 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 blah. And sorry, the dog's crying. he's on the phone with Will, running with Will, whatever it is. And then Jeff runs past me and I was like, who's he on the phone to? And he's not on the phone to anyone. He's holding a banana up to his ear. he's running, pretending he's on the phone, holding a banana to his ear, having a conversation with someone who's not there. I was like, what is going on? Like, my brain, I was in hysterics, but when it stopped, I was like, did I dream that? Am I sleep deprived already? Or like, what's going on? Like, but it's just Jethro being as mad as Jethro is, you know? So, but it was having people there in and out, changing energy, changing the chat was crucial. And it was so good. So.
And how was it through the first night? You know, the sun's coming up the next morning. What, you thought, geez, I haven't even gone 24 hours yet, but I've got, another day coming.
Yeah, look, that first night, I just remember I think it's from 3 to 5 o'clock, and everything, no matter who you're with, the chat is terrible. The chat is silent. There's this eerie feeling like no one wants to be there. And then you start thinking, oh, I've dragged these people out. They could be sleeping. So you start wearing this guilt and you're like, oh, this sucks. And then suddenly the sun starts coming up. Yeah, the sun starts coming up, and then the energy lifts again. And people start chirping, and you forget that the night was really hard. You just completely forget how hard it was. That first morning, we were in Watson's Bay, and that first night I was running with Noah, Mort, for anyone who's listening. So I was running with Mort, and his phone was blowing up the whole time. And he told me, I think it was probably around 3:34, and he was like, mate, Eddie Oss is, he wants to meet up with her. He wants to see her. And I was like, no, I don't think I can. I've got to focus. I can't have the craziness around me at the moment. And he was pestering. And then Noah just stopped telling me about it. It was the morning, and Noah goes, mate, Eddie Oss wants to come see you. I was like, yeah, bugger it. Just bring him down. Let him come. So we're sitting having a brekkie, like just having a quick feed and a coffee. And I reckon there's probably about 10 people around who were running with me, 4 of the blokes I'd never met before in my life. My sisters showed up, and then this bloke on a electric bike starts coming down. I was like, it's a bit weird. He's wearing a kilt. He's wearing a Scottish hat too. And then you just hear, baby, and it's Eddie Oss, and he's on this electric scooter in a kilt and a hat. He'd had a few drinks the night before, and he was just having the best time. He was like, I'm so glad to see you. There's actually a photo, I think it's on my Instagram, of Eddie in the kilt and me standing next to him. And he lifted everyone's spirits, because the first night had been a really long night. So he just lifted absolutely everyone's spirits, and everyone's ready to go again. Yeah. So it was pretty good seeing him. I'm glad he came down and brought the energy. He actually rode his electric bike with us from Watson's Bay to Bondi, and we were going along the gravel and everything, and he was just hooking it next to us, screaming and cheering everyone up, and it was really good. But I think that actually played a really important part, whether he knows it or not, in that coming day, because it was so hot. From the morning, it was boiling, and he got us through a good 3-hour stint and kind of kept everyone's energy up for a fair while, which was massive. It was so good.
Was there parts, obviously, you're into the second day, then you make the 24 hours at 4 p.m., then you're coming into another night. Was there periods that at this stage you haven't slept much? I mean, were you allowed to stop and so probably just to let the listeners know how it all works, you're allowed to stop and eat and you're allowed to stop and rest for a certain period of time?
Yeah, so along that path, we allocated rest stops. That would mean 5-10 minutes just for me to refill my water packs, refill my, because on the run I had to carry my food on me, or one of the people who were running with me was holding my food. So it was just a restock and a quick sit down, check my blisters, check my feet, make sure any lactic was out of my body. Thanks to John, and all my feeds and stuff were sorted thanks to Jamie. And then I'd be on my way again. But it was really important that second, or that, that middle part, which was actually a Thursday, because it was so hot that all my stops were sort of shaded and I could just get some ice on me, because I think it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon and we'd come back from Larpa and we'd just hit Lurline Bay. John was running behind me, and he started seeing me swaying, and he was like, mate, we need to pull up here. We need to chuck some ice on you. You're super dehydrated. I was drinking water like no tomorrow, electrolytes like no tomorrow. But this heat and running in this heat was, it was ruthless. And there's photos, once again, on my Instagram of that day, and I've got an ice pack on my chest, like a servo ice pack on my chest. Ella had brought down frozen towels that she'd frozen at home and chucked them all over me. I've got John walking a roller up my legs. I'm being fed at the same time by someone. The heat was a really big factor for that afternoon, which just made me think how hard the night was going to be, because I'd used so much energy just staying awake and staying alive in the heat that the night I forgot that I had another night to go. So I was just like, when the night came, I was like, this is going to be hell. This is going to be absolute hell. But, you know, it's got to keep pushing on.
Now, obviously people know if you haven't slept for 24 hours, you start, you know, hallucinating. Was there periods that you started to hallucinate at all on the run?
Yeah, I thought it was going to happen sooner after that heat, but it was the second night and we had a massive crew. Like, we had a huge crew going from Bondi to Watson's Bay. I think there was probably like 10 of the boys from work, and there was probably 10 people outside of work, and everyone joined, and we just all marched up to Watson's Bay. And it was my brother, another bloke called Brent Mack, and sort of once we hit Watson's Bay, people started peeling off. And my brother and Brent Mack stayed with me, and we're running back to Bondi, and it was, I think it was about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm running behind my brother, looking at his shoes, and I started swaying once again, like just, you know, veering off to the right and left. He looked behind me and he's like, mate, you're running with your eyes closed. Wake up, wake up. And he's kind of clipping me around the ears. I was like, yeah, sweet. So I'm running again. Brent and my brother are getting further and further away, and they're near a bin, and I look at this bin, and then there's penguins around the bin. And I was like, oh, that's a weird place for penguins to be in the middle of Military Road, you know, up near Dudley Page Reserve there. And I was like, oh, that's weird. As I got closer and closer, what I thought was a penguin just turned into rubbish. I was like, oh, all right, it's kicking in. I'm starting to hallucinate now. And then I looked to the middle of the road, and those white lines, the marking lines in the road, they were lifting up and they were turning into penguins. And so I was like, I've got to see if this is real. So I run into the middle of the road, and, you know, it's flattened out again and it's gone to what it was, and it's just a white line. And I was like, oh, this is weird. We keep running, and my brother looked behind me, and I'm running almost in the middle of the road with my eyes closed. And that's when he called it, and Brent called it as well. Called up Jamie, said, get the van ready. We're chucking him in for, you know, a 10, 20 minute sleep. He needs it. He's not going to, he can't function. He's mumbling. He's just not communicating with us, and he's running with his eyes closed. And Jamie, being the expert that he was, he's like, he needs to have it. Because at that point, I hadn't had any sleep. Had no sleep leading up to that, which was the whole idea. But when it gets dangerous, you just have to put your head down. He goes, otherwise you're going to have serious complications. And the, you know, running next to the cliffs or anything like that, this is where we pull the pin with your safety and just say, you have to do this. So he was the expert. We had to listen to him. So he dropped me for about 20 minutes or so, and then back up out of the van and off we went. So that was at the point about 1 o'clock. That was when I started hallucinating. I was probably nearly 30 hours in or something, which is, from everything that I looked up about sleep deprivation and hallucinating, it's around the 28 hour to 30 hour mark of where you start to lose the plot a little bit.
Now, you got through that. You got to the next day. Now, how was the feeling when you had about, you know, 2 hours to go and you thought, oh, it's nearly to the end?
Oh, mate, time went backwards. That was the longest 2 hours of my life, because we changed to get eyes on to make sure we finished in Bondi. I just started having to run laps of the promenade and up around the back of Bondi. So time was going backwards. My sisters were running with me, Geraldine and Kate, they were running with me. Bo was with me, John, Jamie. Like, I had the best crew possible running with me, and everyone was trying to lift the spirits for that part. But it wasn't helping, knowing that I'd come so far, but I only had 2 hours to go, and it just felt like time was going backwards. Everything was hurting. The heat was catching up with me from the day before, and I was really slowing down. I wasn't talking. My speech was terrible. I blisters, like I was getting shooting pains to my toes, and they were blisters forming. I could feel my toenails falling off in my shoes. Blisters on it, like it was terrible. My back was seizing. Everything sucked. So those 2 hours, it was just like I was just in survival mode, complete and utter survival mode. But at the same time, without the people around me, I wouldn't be able to get it done. They were the ones who were talking, lifting the energy and making sure I was all right, because I'd completely forgotten about eating and drinking. I'd just be going, oh, I've got to keep going. And then Jamie would run up next to me, or my sisters, have you had any water? And I was like, oh, I don't know. I just drink it. And they were filling my bottles, filling it. Like, it's all still full. Like, drink, drink, drink. And I was like, okay. So drinking, and then they were force feeding me, because at this point I'm living off snakes, Alan's snakes, these Morton bars. I was having these cramp shots that taste like pickle juice with vinegar, the worst tasting things ever, but they work a treat. Mm-hmm. And just lollies and chips. I'd been having that every hour on the hour, 48 hours straight. Come the last 2 hours, I could not stomach it. I think it was the 40-hour mark, my stomach turned on me and was like, nah, you can't hold any more of this crap. And I was feeling so sick. Bathrooms could not have been closer but further away. Everything was just going downhill, and I had 2 hours to go, and I just had to keep it together. But I couldn't stomach the food. So they were like, all right, you're just going to have to live off electrolytes that are on your chest, the waters, and water and electrolytes. Don't worry about the food as much. You've got 2 hours. You just have to grit it out. And so we scrapped the food, and I was just trying to drink as much as I could. But the problem was I was forgetting to drink. So it was just like people were constantly reminding me. And because I was so tired, I was a bit snappy. People were like, have you drunk? And I was like, oh, just beat it, go away, you know, like obviously not in those words, but it was just, I was in survival mode, and I was just doing my best to make the 2 hours to get to the 48. That was it.
And how good was it at the end when, you know, I was down there as well, and there's so many people around, and you know, they formed this massive line, and you ran through it, and, you know, the moment you cross the line and finish and achieve something that, yeah, all right, I'd say that majority or pretty much nearly all the population, there'd be only a small amount of people that would be able to do that.
Yeah, look, I remember being at North Bondi with Jamie, and I saw all these white shirts, because obviously Bo had organised to raise money, like, you know, there's 48-hour shirts, and all these white shirts are behind the tower, and I was like, what are those white shirts up there? And Jamie's like, mate, that's for you. Like, let's get there. And I was like, oh, okay, this is weird. I was expecting just family, friends, and the boys, like obviously all my mates at work, everyone there just to sort of poke their heads out. Well done, awesome. Have a beer at the end. That's it. As I'm getting closer, the cheers are getting louder and louder. I'm like, what the hell? Then from about where the stairs are, there's like just there's a tunnel, and people are clapping, cheering. There's people up on the, you know, the road there cheering, and it was just a really weird feeling. And I just see Ella and my family and Bo at the end, and I was like, oh, this is sick. And I just had tunnel vision for them. And next minute I'm just feeling the boys slapping me on the back and the back of the head, cheering me on. So it was, it was cool. I hit that finish line, and it was something that I don't think I'll ever experience again in my life. And I tried to lap it up for as long as I could. But, yeah, mate, it was something pretty special. One of my good mates, Sammy, he calls me the poor man's Ned Brockman. So, you know, even to be used in the same sentence as Ned Brockman's a pretty big honor. I like that. I'll take it. But yeah, crossing the finish line, mate, it beat any grand final that I've been in or anything like that. It was pretty special. It was very, very special.
It was an amazing moment when you finished. And how many, do you know how many kilometres you actually did? And also you're raising money. How much money did you raise for the charity?
Yeah, so the kilometres that I did, off the top of my head, I think it was 165.2 kilometres in the 48. And the charity's still open now until the Bondi Rescue episode airs. At the moment we're sitting at $22,800, I'm pretty sure. The goal was to hit $48,000. to raise money for obviously Bottle, the mental health charity, to help people in the local community with mental health through movement. So there's run clubs and everything like that. So yeah, we're still hoping that, you know, that the funds climb as that episode airs. So it is still open if anyone who listens wants to donate. I did complete the 48 hours. It's all documented. So if you want to see it, head over to our Instagram Bottle. It's Instagram or my Instagram. It's all there. So yeah, we've raised a good amount of money.
Yeah, no, it's a good effort. And I can confirm you actually did do it. One lap or two laps of the promenade with you. And I think you'd already done about 36 or 40 hours, and I'm struggling to keep up with you then.
Yeah, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt there. You had a bung leg, mate. So I'll let that one slide. If you're 100% fit and healthy, I'd be giving you grief, but you were a bit damaged there. So I'll let it slide.
Yeah, you're a good bloke, mate. You're a good bloke.
Yeah. Mate, that's all you said to me the other day.
No. Well, it's a different story at work. It's a different story. Mate, it's a magnificent achievement. You should be really proud of it. And I'm pretty sure all of us at work are, and all your friends and family. So well done, mate, on the effort. Now, I just want to touch on another thing. You recently had a baby boy.
Yeah.
And that wasn't long after completing the 48 hours. So tell us about that. And it wasn't probably a normal situation either.
No, okay. So my poor wife, she has been through, I reckon the last 14 months, she's been through absolute hell with me. I'm probably the hardest person to get along with, let alone put up with. She's a saint. Yeah, look, everything was about maybe, two months after the run, we had our first child, Lockie. Yeah, it didn't exactly go to plan. It was actually quite a scary birth, to be honest. Everything leading up, Ella's so diligent about everything she does, and especially being her first child, she just wanted to tick all the boxes, make sure everything was right. And she was doing such an incredible job. The labor, everything was going really, really well. And then she gave birth, no drugs, all natural. Lockie came out healthy, what we thought was healthy. He was kind of screaming. And anyway, the doctors took Lockie away, and I had a look at him. I was like, oh, this is my son. This is awesome. Then went back to Ella, gave her a kiss, and then I looked at her, and she just went ash gray. And as you know from, the work that we've done, ash gray is the only color that we can relate to someone who we've resuscitated or someone who's dead. And anyway, I look at the bed, and it dead set looks like a red paint tin has been kicked over, and there was blood everywhere. It went from being myself and Ella and two midwives and a doctor with Lockie in the room to 15 other nurses coming in. Everyone had a job. They did a tremendous job. They were unbelievable. And Ella kind of just was ash gray, and next minute I was pulled to the side. They were working on Ella. And this doctor came over to me and goes, hey, we just want to talk to you about Lockie. I was like, yeah, okay. Well, he's not breathing. And when he does breathe, he's not breathing well. So he needs to go to the NICU center, which is the neonatal ICU. And I was like, oh, okay, all right. Well, like, I was just shell-shocked. There are people working on Ella. I'm just hearing that my, two-minute-old son now has to go to ICU. I don't know what to do. I'm helpless at this point. And then next minute I look over my shoulder and they're wheeling Ella away, and I couldn't even sort of say anything to her or see her. One of the doctors or the midwives turned around and was like, look, she's got to go to emergency surgery. She's lost 2.5 liters of blood in 15 minutes, I think it was. So that's a significant amount for her to lose, or anyone to lose, in that short a period of time. So yeah, she was wheeled away to intensive care. Next minute, it was having, 15 or more people in a room, to a room completely empty. My whole family's gone. My wife's having surgery done. From my last look at her, it was like she was pretty much gone. And then hearing that my son, who's 2 minutes old, has complications with his breathing. I'm just circling these thoughts in my head, and I think it was probably, I think it was about an hour and a half to 2 hours in that, you know, someone, the midwife actually came up to me and was like, you know, I haven't heard anything about Ella, but do you want to see Lockie? And I was like, yeah, you know, an hour and a half or whatever, 2 hours without hearing anything about your newborn son or anything, hearing about how your wife's going, how the surgery went, if the surgery is still going or anything like that, you know, and not getting an answer. I was about to tear the doors off the place. So yeah, I was just trying to keep my cool and sort of keep my composure as best I could. But luckily, you know, the midwife took me to Lockie, and he was in the neonatal intensive care unit. And it was as soon as I saw him, I was just fighting back tears because, you know, my newborn son is just hooked up to all these machines, his breathing apparatuses, and you can't really see his face. Like, he's got this mask on him, he's got this head piece on him, and you know, things coming out of his chest and like, you know, monitors and everything. And it was just like, yeah, it was something else. And then so while I'm there, I'm sort of just holding his little hand, and you know, another hour has gone by and I still haven't heard anything about Ella. So your brain kind of just goes to the worst case. And I was like, righto, you're a single dad now, this is what you got to do. Like, just I started prepping myself for being a single father. And yeah, I was just seeing in my own head, you know, what life was going to be like without, you know, Ella, you know. And you know me and Ella, she's my 5'8" mate, so like it'd be a pretty rough stretch, near impossible without her. So yeah, it was a really rubbish 4 hours, I would say. And then the midwife came in again and she was like, look, she's in recovery now. Everything went well. They've stopped the bleed. You know, do you want to go in and see her? And yeah, it was this like conflicting thing. I got my son here and then my wife's at the other side of the hospital. I'm like, oh, can you stay here and look after my son while I go see my wife? And, you know, people have it pretty, like when you go to a hospital and you see the intensive care unit and these tiny little children have been born at, you know, 30 weeks, 28 weeks, and you know, they don't even leave these incubators pretty much. And I was upset, I was angry, I was confused, but I kind of put everything into perspective really fast, because holding Lockie's hand was something special, and then hearing that my wife is still alive was even better. And I was just like, look, this was a terrible start. This was he's grounded for a long time, but it was a terrible start. But I'm just so, so happy that I've got my family, and, you know, I don't have to have that thought anymore of being a single dad or, you know, it's just, yeah, I'm super relieved and I'm super, super lucky. So wasn't the best start, but you know, it's a start we got and we just move on from that. So yeah.
But it would have been horrific at that period, as you said, the first 3 or so hours, and potentially you've gone in, you know, excited, you're going to have a newborn baby, and then suddenly it just flips on its head where potentially you could have lost both in just matter of minutes.
Yeah, well, that was my initial thought when we were in the birthing unit and everything was going south. I was like, am I not going to have anyone? Like, am I – like what – because your brain can't help it but go to the worst case. And then, you know, I saw what Ella looked like, and then I heard the news from the doctor, I'm just going, my head's just spinning, and I couldn't really make sense of it all. And I was angry because everything leading up that labor period, Ella was an absolute tough nut. Like, she was hard as nails. Everything was going so well. And then, you know, flick of a switch, shit just hit the fan and it all just fell away. And I was like, it's just, you're not expecting it. From everything going so good to everything going so bad, you're just going, this sucks. So, but like I said, I can't be upset. I can't be upset anymore. I've got what I wanted, you know, like my family. I got my wife. She's fit and healthy. She's doing amazing. I've got Lockie, who's screaming the house down and, you know, constantly changing nappies, but I wouldn't have it any other way. It's pretty bloody special.
Yeah, well, mate, it is, and it's a good result in the end, and it's something that you can treasure now. And as you said, you can kick back, and hopefully it's it's all good.
I wouldn't
again.
Say kick back. Kicking back's a stretch at the moment.
Well, mate, you haven't asked to come back to work yet, so I reckon when you ask me to come back to work, means you might have had too much work at home.
I'm back on Wednesday, mate. Don't worry. I need the routine as much.
Sometimes
as I
it's
love
easier
it.
At work, mate, than at home.
Yeah. Well, it depends if Gons is working. It's hard work then.
All right. Well, mate, thanks, mate, for having a chat.
Yeah, thank you.
And talking about your the 48 hours and also the birth of your of Lockie's. It's
yeah.
It's you've got two massive achievements, haven't you, in the last in the last few months.
Yeah, definitely. I'm definitely more proud of having Lockie than I am of the 48. So it's it's pretty cool.
Well, mate, at the end of the interview, I do some five fun facts. I'm just going to throw some questions at you.
Sure thing.
What are the best and worst purchases you've ever made?
Look, I'm going to say the best purchase is also my worst purchase. It was my first scooter. I picked it up at Absolute Storm. You know, when I first became a lifeguard, I was like, yeah, this is red hot. I'm going to be no parking fines, park wherever I want. You know, sure enough, give it a week later, the thing broke down about three times. I think I ended up leaving it in Kensington. I left it in Kensington and it actually got one of those just dumping notices on it. Yeah. So on top of that, I got another fine because I just left it and forgot about it. And then I got a fine in the mail saying illegal dumping.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was my best and worst purchase all in one.
Mate, cats or dogs and why?
I'm a dog man every day of the week. Dogs are they're loyal. They're protective. They're loving. Like, they're just the best things ever. And, you know, they make you get outside, whereas a cat, you know, cats are, no offense to cat people, but they're pretty boring. You buy them a scratch post and a couple of fake mice and they're happy, but a dog, you know, you got to take and throw the ball. And people might say dogs are stupid, but they're pretty onto it. I'd also say that my dog is my best and worst purchase. You know, he gives us so much love and joy, but at the same time, holy hell, does he give us a headache.
Mate, what are you most proud of?
Mate, I'm going to say I'm most proud of my son. Nothing can surpass that. That's, that's my proudest moment, becoming a dad.
What's the most interesting thing you've read or seen this week?
I wouldn't say I've had much time for reading. and anything apart from looking at Lockie, it's been a bit tough. But I would say just learning about sort of the breastfeeding journey and that whole aspect of new parenthood is pretty interesting. I don't do the reading. As you know, my reading skills aren't exactly up to scratch. So Ella's the teacher. She does the reading and then she tells me all the facts. So everything to do with becoming a new parent and learning all of that. It's always pretty interesting and you learn fast or you sink a little bit.
Mate, what song do you have to sing along with when you hear it?
Mate, it would have to be a song by Zach Bryan. He's a country music artist and, as you know, big fan of that.
You love the country. You love the country.
You walk into the tower a lot and all you hear is country music from me. You shake your head and walk out most times. But, yeah, a song by Zach Bryan called Nine Ball. It's every time it comes on, I just can't help but sing it and, give a little dance to it. So it's a cracker song.
Mate, well, it's been a pleasure having you in and having a chat. So hopefully I'll catch you back at work very soon next week. Yeah, so
thanks, Bruce. Thanks for the chat, mate. And, we'll see you next Wednesday.
Good to have you back.
Perfect. See you, mate. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Remember to subscribe to Life's a Beach wherever you get your podcasts and hit us up with questions, comments, or follow us on our social media channels, which you can find in our show notes. That's it for today, beach fans. Stay safe and swim between the flags.